start off by telling you a story. I was in high school. It was my first time at Symphony Hall in Cincinnati. And to be honest, I was a little overwhelmed. I was a young high school student. The building was pretty impressive. The program featured music by Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, and Stravinsky. The whole evening just sort of smelled serious. And I had never been to a symphony concert before. I was with an older classmate who was kind of experienced with the whole symphony thing. And, you know, he kind of helped me navigate through the whole situation. We take our seats, the lights go down, and we hear the famous opening chords. And I mean, I was absolutely in heaven. I never experienced live music like that before. So for the next 7 or 8 minutes during that first movement, I mean, I'm just on the edge of my seat. I'm loving every second of it. And you know, if you know that piece, it ends with those classic dun, 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 dun. And I mean, I was so thrilled. So I jump to my feet and I'm applauding as loud as I can. And I'm thinking to myself, this was so incredible. It was so awesome. And then I'm overwhelmed by this sense that I feel like I'm the only one doing this. And I look around and realize I am the only one doing this. And the guy sitting beside me is like, sit down, sit down. And so I sit down and I said, what was that? And he said, no clapping, not yet. I said, why not? And he said, it's only the first movement. I said, yeah, but it was a great movement. And he said, we don't clap after the first movement. You have to wait until the whole piece is done. So that's like 20 minutes I gotta wait. And I'm sitting there the whole time, just so frustrated. And I'm thinking to myself, I think Beethoven would have appreciated the fact that I stood up. If I had known what bravo meant, I would have yelled it. I mean, I thought it was just fantastic. I felt emotionally constipated because I had wanted to express something, but I was told it wasn't appropriate. I wasn't supposed to do it. Now, I later went on to teach music appreciation. I would take my students to a symphony concert, and before the concert, I would give them, you know, the rules. And one of the rules was, now, no matter how much you like the first movement, you wait until the whole piece is over. And invariably, somebody would say, why? And I would just have to say, I don't know, but we just have to do it that way. I mean, there's something about the whole experience that's very frustrating. Now, not long ago, I was part of a Sunday morning worship service. And I mean, it was just one of those kind of anointed mornings. And I mean, the music was just perfect and people were really expressing emotion and they were just so into the whole experience. And we finished this one song in particular where we just held that last chord, seemed like forever, you know. And when it was over, you could tell that every person in the room just wanted to, yeah. I mean, it was one of those moments, right? But we were well behaved and so we did not. We all wanted to, we just sort of stood there, emotionally constipated. Until a little 2-year-old boy at the back of the auditorium suddenly yelled out, yay! And then he yelled something I've never actually heard anyone yell before. He went, hooray! And it was like he suddenly gave everybody permission. And I said, come on, don't we all want to do that? And everybody started cheering. Now the question I have is, why doesn't that happen more often? I mean, the Psalms are filled with these references to, you know, worship with gladness and shout for joy and, you know, clap your hands, all ye people. And I guess I kind of grew up thinking, well, yeah, but that's Old Testament. You know, in the New Testament, we know better. Now, I think personally that one of the biggest obstacles that all of us face when it comes to worship is fear. And it comes in a lot of different shapes and sizes, a lot of different varieties. Maybe one of these will strike you. For example, there's the fear of being too spontaneous. You know, I remember being brought up over and over, I heard the phrase, decently and in order. And so if you've been brought up with the phrase decently and in order, if anything happens that's out of order, it makes you very nervous. An assembly is supposed to have a plan. And if you follow the plan, you're good. If you get off the plan, you're in trouble. And I mean, it can go a number of different ways. The plan can be as simple as 3 songs, a prayer, a song, communion. It can be that kind of plan. But to tell you the truth, in terms of being spontaneous, you can have a very, quote, contemporary service that's so carefully scripted that I'm convinced if Jesus himself showed up and said, I'd like to share a thought, the worship minister would go, sorry, it's not in the order of worship. You know, so there's that fear of being spontaneous in worship. Another fear is being too emotional. I'll never forget the first time I heard someone actually shout out, amen, during a service. And I mean, I was mortified. I'm looking around like, where is that guy's mother? You know, does he not know that we don't shout in worship? I mean, that guy is crazy. One of the side effects of the whole worship renewal movement that we talked about in the first class was that there is a certain freedom that people are beginning to feel about expressing emotion in worship. And so you begin to hear people, more people, not just black churches, people saying hallelujah or amen, people who are clapping both during the music, after something that happens, people feeling freer to kneel down or to lift their hands when they sing. But for a lot of us, I think when you're emotional, you're not in control. The dumbest thing I ever said as a husband was, we'll talk about this when you calm down. I paid for that for years. But, I mean, we have that feeling, don't we? If you're emotional, you're not really in control of yourself. You know, it's a little irrational, and we need to sort of nip it in the bud, as Barney Fife would say. Another fear we have is a fear of being too denominational. You know, I remember when I was in high school, my best friend Bob was Catholic. And so I would go to the Catholic Church once a year, so he would owe me one, and he'd have to come to the one true church. And the truth is, and he could pull anything on me when I would sit there because I didn't know anything about Catholicism. And so, like, you know, there would be a procession of people coming in, and I would go, who's that? And he would say, that's the Grand Poobah. I'd be like, the Poobah? What a funny word. You know, I had no idea that he was pulling my leg because I didn't know anything about Catholicism. I didn't want to know anything about Catholicism. I didn't figure that the Catholics had anything at all to offer me spiritually or otherwise. And so I think that in a tradition that has typically been very removed from any other denomination, the idea of any kind of cross-pollination is pretty scary for us. And a lot of these things that are coming into our worship experiences are coming from outside groups. We have, you know, our men go to Promise Keepers, or our women go to Women of Faith, and they come back and they say, hey, I saw this thing, or we experienced this thing, we did this thing. Do you think maybe we could do it in our church? And there's a certain immediacy to all of that, I think, that makes some of us nervous. And it's frightening, I think, to some people. Another fear, the fear of offending people. And this one is a little different. You know, 1 Corinthians 8 says that we're not supposed to cause a brother to stumble. And I think that's a really serious concept. I think it's something we all need to take very seriously. On the other hand, if we're not careful, that sensitivity can turn into a paralyzing fear that stops all kinds of good things from happening. I remember one time I was scheduled to speak at a youth rally in Colorado. And on the Friday before I was supposed to fly out later in the day, the person who was organizing the rally called me and said, you know, I just want to run through the schedule again just to make sure we're good. He said, you know, you arrive at such and such, we'll go get some dinner, we'll go to the church building, we'll have a meeting with the elders, and then the rally will start. I said, wait. I said, you mentioned something that I don't remember coming up before, the meeting with the elders. I said, what's that about? And this person said, well, you know, it's no big deal. They just want to meet with you to make sure that you're not going to say anything that might offend someone. Now, I'm thinking, this is the Friday of the event. I'm getting ready to go to the airport. You might have asked that question a little sooner, you know. And I said, well, are they really worried that I'm going to say something that's going to offend someone? And he said, well, no, not necessarily. I said, are they easily offended? No, the elders aren't easily offended at all. And I said, well, I don't quite get this point. And he said, well, we have some members in our congregation who are easily rattled. We have some older people, and, you know, we just want to make sure you don't offend them. And I asked the obvious question, how many of those older people will be coming to the youth rally? And the answer just stunned me. This person said, well, actually, none of them, but they might hear about it. And that was enough to put the red flags up. They might hear about something that might offend them. And so, you know, we sort of say we have to be so careful I remember a conversation at another church one time. I was meeting with some elders after a thing, and we're having a lunch thing, and we're talking about different changes that were happening. And this one elder said, well, you know, we have to move very slowly because, you know, some people really have a hard time with change. And this guy's daughter, his adult daughter, who was hosting this little dinner, said, "Dad, we are moving so slow, nobody knows we are moving at all." And I think that's true in a lot of places because we have this fear of offending people. And I think it's really important for us to recognize that there is a significant difference between causing someone to lose their faith, which is what 1 Corinthians is talking about, and making someone a little uncomfortable. And so even though we want to be very sensitive about offending people, we don't want it to turn into a paralyzing, stopping fear. One of the fears that I had to deal with, to be honest, it may sound funny coming from a Zoe guy, was the whole concept of being too entertaining. Worship was worship, entertainment was something else. You know, so one singer with a microphone on a stage was worship. Several singers with microphones on a stage was Dollywood. You know, and so I didn't want to have anything to do with that. You know, praise teams, special music, drama, video screens, the whole thing sort of smelled like entertainment, and entertainment was inherently bad, right? I mean, there's where the disconnect were from. It was like, wait a minute, entertainment is not inherently bad. Well, that's the thing. You know, it's incredible to me because I think some of the most significant moral lessons I've ever learned have not been from a sermon. They've been from a movie. Some of the most moving experiences that I've ever had that have changed my heart and life were from songs, not from sermons. And I have to admit, it's just what you said. I got to thinking about it. You know what? I love certain preachers because they are so engaging, you know? Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say entertainment. I couldn't say that, but I could say they were engaging. You know, and I think, I mean, it goes all the way back. When I was a kid, I remember hearing Ira North preach from the Madison Church. And his opening of every sermon was 10 minutes of jokes. They didn't necessarily have anything to do with his sermon. They were just hilarious. And I loved listening to him preach. Nowadays, there's a bit more integration, and so you hear somebody like Randy Harris, who is a very fun... Randy and I spent 2 weeks together in Singapore last year, and he is a hysterical guy. Or I think, you know, one of my best buddies, Jeff Walling. Jeff Walling's bachelor's degree is in theater, not Bible, which is one of the reasons why he is so engaging. You know, he knows how to use his voice. He knows how to create a story, to draw you in. He is entertaining. And I think, you know, that's why so many people invite these guys to come and speak all over the country and why thousands of people flock to hear them speak. It doesn't mean that they don't offer really strong, solid gospel teaching, but they do it in such an entertaining way. Ultimately, though, for me, it came down to the fear of doing worship wrong. And I think that's probably the foundation for a lot of people. When I was young, I saw the New Testament as a blueprint. And so if you knew where to look, you could find clear instructions on how to live and how to worship the right way. And there was a certain way things were supposed to be done. And if you didn't do them that way, they didn't count. It's sort of like forgetting to hit send after you write an email. You know, it doesn't go anywhere. And so if you didn't follow the formula, you were doing it wrong. I'd heard these stories. Man, I'd heard these stories about Nadab and Abihu. And they, you know, offered a type of worship that they weren't supposed to offer, and God turned them into crispy critters. And, you know, I just got the impression that the Bible was filled with all kinds of stories about people who were warned about doing worship wrong. I had a clear idea of what it was supposed to be like, and if you strayed from that picture, then the consequences could be really, really terrible. And I think that's enough to scare anyone. Eventually, though, I began to look at worship in a new light. Ironically, I began to realize that for someone who hadn't paid that much attention to the Old Testament, I was actually looking at worship through a kind of Old Testament filter. And I think that's true for a lot of us. And I want to take a few minutes to sort of explain what that means for me. There are some really significant differences between Old Testament and New Testament when it comes to worship. Okay, for example, one of the big things that's quite surprising is that the volume of material about worship is dramatically different between Old Testament and New Testament. I heard a teacher one time say that there are over 1,100 verses dealing specifically with worship in the first five books of the Old Testament alone. 1,100 verses. And we're not even talking about the Psalms. 1,100 verses. In contrast, there are about 136 verses in the entire New Testament. And the only significant blocks are chapters 11 and 14 of 1 Corinthians. The other references are just sort of a verse here, a couple of verses there. So the volume of material is very different. Also, the nature of the material is different as well. I think if you look at Scripture, you basically find three different types of material related to worship. And I'm going to try to make these as clear as we can for you. The first is prescriptive. Those are passages about worship that are basically a recipe. It's almost like a cookbook. And then you also have passages that are narrative. Stories about people worshiping, where they're worshiping, what they're doing, that kind of stuff. Sort of like a scrapbook or a snapshot. And then finally, the third type is what you would call corrective passages, where people have done something in worship and God is displeased for whatever reason, and certain people are tasked with telling the people, hey, you did this wrong. Okay, so prescriptive, narrative, and corrective. The Old Testament has examples of all three. Okay, here's an example of a little snapshot, a narrative. When all the Israelites saw the fire coming down and the glory of the Lord above the temple, this is when they're dedicating the temple, they knelt on the pavement with their faces to the ground, and they worshiped. It's a pretty vivid picture. Again, it's like a snapshot. We see the temple. We see the people of God dedicating the temple. We see God showing up in this rather miraculous way with smoke, and people are terrified. They fall on their face, etc. So that's an example of Old Testament narrative. Old Testament prescriptive, and see, this is why I say it's sometimes like a recipe. Listen to this passage from Leviticus. If you bring a grain offering baked in an oven, it is to consist of fine flour, cakes made without yeast and mixed with oil, or wafers made without yeast and spread with oil. If your grain offering is prepared on a griddle, see what I mean about sort of a almost like a recipe? God's saying, here's exactly how I want you to do it. I'll give you the ingredients. I'll tell you how long to keep it in the oven. I mean, I'm going to be as specific as possible about this. And the Old Testament has a bunch of stuff like that. Even the tabernacle that we talked about this morning. There's chapter after chapter. This is the kind of material. This is the color. These are the kinds of ornaments. And this is the kind of altar we want. Here's how I want you to make it. Here's the silver here, gold here. The priests are going to wear this kind. I mean, it's detailed, really detailed. And then finally, Old Testament corrective. Man, the last half of the Old Testament is all corrective. All the prophets saying, whoa, you guys messed it up. You didn't do it the way you were supposed to do it. This one I think is very interesting from Jeremiah 17. Keep the Sabbath day holy, as I commanded your forefathers, yet they did not listen or pay attention. They were stiff-necked and would not listen or respond to discipline. But if you are careful to obey me. Okay, so it's corrective. It's saying they didn't do it right. I want you to do it right. Old Testament, examples of all three. In the New Testament, you still find examples of description. Here's a New Testament narrative. Acts 2, every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes. They ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. Again, it's just a snapshot. Here's the early church. Here's what they did. They met together. They shared meals, etc. One of the more interesting ones for me growing up was as a preacher's son. Remember the story in Acts 20 about Eutychus? He falls asleep in the sermon, falls out the window, and dies. Man, you know, every time I'd start to nod off during one of Dad's sermons, you know, there'd be that, Eutychus, Eutychus, Eutychus. Pretty effective narrative. And there are also examples of corrective. Those longer passages we talked about in 1 Corinthians 11 and 14, they're corrective passages. And in this case, he's saying, okay, look, in the following directives, I have no praise for you. For your meetings do more harm than good. In the first place, I hear that when you come together as a church, there are divisions among you, and to some extent, I believe it. And then he goes on, and this church apparently had a lot of problems. You know, there were divisions over which preacher was best. There were struggles with sexual immorality among some of the members. There were some members taking other members to court. And so some of that friction had found its way into their worship times. And so there were people who were turning communion into kind of a raucous meal and not being considerate of others. And so they'd actually get drunk during communion. There was confusion and chaos caused by the abuse of spiritual gifts. There seemed to have been some women who were causing trouble by doing some stuff they weren't supposed to be doing. And so Paul addresses all of this, and he's very specific about, you're doing it wrong, here's the corrective, here's the way I want you to do it. Now, it's interesting, I think we can gain insight from all of these passages, but it's important for us to recognize that correctives are almost always addressed to specific people and situations, and they don't necessarily apply to all people and situations. And that's sort of a principle related to corrective passages that's important for us to realize. And, you know, same thing, you go back to the Old Testament. Some of the things that they were saying, don't do this, you're supposed to do that, we would not think, well, that's supposed to be forever. You know, we're supposed to prepare this sacrifice, this particular one. We don't even do sacrifices anymore. Because it was good for that time, good for those people, not so much for us. Only prescriptive passages have that kind of long-range impact. And in the New Testament, interestingly enough, you just don't find prescriptive passages about worship. Recipes are noticeably missing. And instead, throughout the New Testament, prescriptive language is replaced by principle. Okay, let that sort of sink in for a minute. I know we're going really fast, but I want you to sort of think about that statement for a minute. Prescriptive language is replaced by principle. Okay, for example, let's say in the New Testament you were going to have the same kind of prescriptive writing about communion that you find in the Old Testament. Okay, you would probably find a passage like this one. Take unleavened bread made of fine flour mixed with oil and baked in an oven, etc., etc., etc. Here are the details. Here's exactly how you do it, step by step by step. In the New Testament, instead, what you get is, whenever you do this, and you're getting vague from the very first word. Whenever you do this, remember me. That's a principle. Another principle, examine yourself. Don't partake with an unworthy heart. That's not a checklist of here's how you do it. It's a principle. Whenever you do it, wherever you do it, however you do it, make sure that your heart is right. For years, I believed that if you broke the rules regarding the externals of worship, we were ignoring or defying the authority of Jesus. But the truth is, Jesus just doesn't say much about worship. And he doesn't say anything about the specifics of worship. Think about that for a minute. Okay, as I read the New Testament, instead of finding a rule book, I see instructions regarding the internals of worship. That's why I think in the beginning of chapter 9 of the book of Hebrews, you have a writer who sort of acknowledges this whole thing. Here's what he says. Hebrews 9:1. Now the first covenant, he's talking about the Old Testament, the first covenant had regulations for worship and also an earthly sanctuary. So he's sort of setting it up. Here's the way it used to be. And then he sort of changes it around and he says, okay, the gifts and sacrifices being offered were not able to clear the conscience of the worshiper. They are only a matter of food and drink and various ceremonial washings, external regulations applying until the time of the new order. So he's saying, everything that I gave you those careful instructions about, that was the old way. And now, he says, something different is taking place. He says verse 18, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to gloom and storm. In other words, remember the Israelites are there, they're gathered around the mountain, and they've been told, if you even touch this mountain while Moses is on it, you will die. And so the writer of Hebrews is saying, you haven't come to that kind of a mountain. You haven't come to a mountain where the sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I'm trembling with fear. You have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. I love that expression, joyful assembly. You have come to the mediator of Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, Jesus, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a word better than the blood of Abel. So when it comes to worship, the New Testament is not an instruction manual or a rule book. When I finally got that, it was like the fear just sort of went away. I used to be afraid to worship. And again, I know that probably sounds weird and may even seem insincere, but I promise you it's true. I mean, I really did grow up thinking, if I mess this up, my eternal soul is in jeopardy. I don't think that way anymore. I used to be afraid of worship, but I'm not anymore. And I guess the question that I have for you today is, How about you? Are you afraid to worship? Are you worried about doing worship wrong? When it comes to this part of your life, are you seeing God through Old Testament eyes? Now, ironically, even in the Old Testament, and I never heard these stories, God showed grace to worshipers who messed up if their hearts were right. This was a revelation to me. For example, in 2 Chronicles 30, you hear about Hezekiah. And Hezekiah has a great heart. He wants to reestablish the celebration of the Passover, which has been kind of done away with for a long time. And so he gets all the people together and they celebrate Passover. The Passover, by the way, is one of those things where God has given prescription about. Here's how you do it. Here's every little detail of how you do it. Hezekiah does it wrong. He knowingly celebrates in the wrong month. Most of the people who participate don't go through the purification ritual that is required if you're doing the Passover. And they were having such a great time, it lasted a week longer than it was supposed to. And Hezekiah knew it. He knew it was all wrong. And so he prays to God, "May the Lord, who is good, pardon everyone who sets his heart on seeking God, even if he is not clean according to the rules of the sanctuary." Now, if you've got the Nadab and Abihu sensibility, that prayer is going to be meaningless. He is toast. He messed up big time. Instead, God accepts and blesses the worship of Hezekiah. Now, I think for a lot of people, this is kind of a startling realization. Because a lot of people think that there's really only one way to worship. And if you do it wrong, then you're in trouble. If you do it wrong, somehow God is going to be displeased. But I think, really, when it comes to worship, God has given us incredible freedom of how we worship. You know, I mean, there are a number of people who say, you know, there's only one way to worship God. And in a sense, that's true. Jesus' one big statement is, hey, you worship me with a right heart, in spirit and truth. You are supposed to do that. But as far as the details of how you worship in spirit and truth, that part is kind of left up to us. I think it's because God knows that time is constantly changing. Circumstances are constantly changing. That's why he's more interested in the heart, because everybody's always going to be dealing with their heart. When I was a student at Rochester College, I had this office in this building. It was a converted garage. And so my office, you would go back in the garage, and they built some rooms back in sort of the basement. It was kind of a creepy place, but I still loved it. And every now and then, because it was the former garage basement, critters would make their way into my office. And I remember one day coming in, hearing a noise, and I immediately knew what it was. 20 minutes later, my student secretary, this girl named Kim, she came in and she said, "Mr. Gill, why are you standing on your desk?" And for the first time, I start to feel a little silly because I've been standing on the desk for 20 minutes. And I said, "Kim, I don't want you to be afraid. Now I'm trying to be the hero, and I'm the one standing on the desk. There is a mouse behind the piano." She said, "What?" And I said, "Really, there's a large mouse behind the piano." Well, Kim had grown up in like a farm, and so the prospect of a mouse was not terrifying to her. And she goes, "Well, what? How does it help for you to be standing on the desk?" And so now I'm thinking, well, I probably should be proactive. This is getting embarrassing. So I get down and I take this broom. And I said, "Okay, here's what I want you to do. You stand at that end of the piano. I'm going to stand over here by the door. And I want you to scare the mouse so the mouse comes running out from behind the piano. And I will scoot it out the door. And it will be free." And she said, "How do you scare a mouse?" I said, "I don't know, meow or something." So she's down on her knees at the end of the piano. And she's going, "Meow, meow, meow, meow." And I'm there with this broom, right? And my intention is, scoot it out the door. Well, the mouse comes out from behind the piano. Any sensible mouse would have headed for the open door rather than the large man holding a broom. Well, this was not a sensible mouse. It came at me in a threatening manner. It's coming straight at me, right? I raised the broom, and I must have hit it 40 times. And when it was over, it was like there's straw all over the place, you know. And I'm looking down, and this mouse is, I mean, it literally, it's like 4 inches long, and it's flat. And I look up, and Kim's got this look like, "This, I'm in the same room with Hannibal Lecter." I mean, she was petrified. And I said, "Kim, I'm so sorry you saw that." And I said, "I might have overreacted somewhat." And she said, do you really think that was necessary? And I said, well, probably not, but it was coming at me in a threatening way, which she did not buy at all. And just at that, and I said, if I had it to do over again, I would not have done that. Just like the cartoon, the mouth pops back up and heads at me again. And this time, I'm sure I got it 100 times before it stopped. And when I just looked at her, I said, don't say anything. Now, it's a dumb story, but I'll tell you the story to say this. I think right now there are a number of people who are witnessing this pendulum swing. And they're seeing stuff happening in worship that really scares them to death. Truth be told, if you think about the video we saw in the first class, truth be told, the changes we're seeing are really not that dramatic. I spoke at a church one time in Louisiana, and this guy said, hey, I should let you know before you get here. It's a church of 100. And he said, we made some changes in worship, and we lost 20 people. Church of 100, that's 20%. I said, man, you must have really made some dramatic changes. And he said, well, we didn't think so at the time. I said, what'd you do? And he said, we moved the announcements from the end of the service to the beginning of the service, and we moved the offering to after the sermon instead of before the sermon with the communion. I said, and 20% of your congregation left? I said, yeah. Some of the changes that we're seeing are really not that dramatic. Anytime somebody comes to me at campus and says, I think the worship here is just really getting a little too out of hand and wild and raucous, I'll say, you really need to get out more. You know, these are not big things that are happening. What we call contemporary is so stinking far from contemporary. But anyway, I digress. Anyway, the idea is that the pendulum is swung, we're afraid, and our first reaction when we're afraid is to strike, is to protect ourselves. We find it personally threatening. This little thing is scaring me to death, so I'm going to overreact. I think that there is a better way to handle it. In the book of Joshua, chapter 22, is a fascinating story about conflict and worship, and this is how we'll end today. Israel has conquered its enemies, it's taken possession of the promised land, and their soldiers from Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh who leave to go home to their families on the other side of the Jordan River. Before they cross the river, they build an altar. Well, word gets back to the leaders of the other tribes that these folks have built an altar. And they immediately find that very threatening. They don't have any of the details, but they're scared to death. And so they send a delegation to these other tribes, and basically they say these things. What do you think you're doing? God is not going to like this, and we are all going to pay for it. Because their assumption is that these folks have built an altar to some unknown god and then crossed over the river, and now the altar is on their side of the river. And so, man, who knows what's going to happen? Well, these folks who've now gone across the river, they send back a delegation and go, whoa, Nelly, that is not what we intended at all. They say, really, we built the altar as a constant reminder that those of you on this side of the river and those of us on the other side of the river share the same God and that we worship the same God. It's a reminder to us that we are all in this together. At which point, the guys who were so upset go, oh, remember Rosanna Dana? Never mind. You know, they realize, oh, well, then never mind. You know, far be it from us to rebel against the Lord, the one group says. And so the other group says, well, thank goodness and everything is fine. The answer is never war. The answer is never fear. The answer is always understanding and patience and acceptance and the realization that all of us share the same God, that we are all worshiping in our own ways. And so I think sometimes we just kind of have to let go. We have to recognize that some change is good. When I was a college student, I decided in my freshman year that I would grow my hair as long as was humanly possible. Because I was a preacher's kid. I'd never been able to grow my hair before. I was pretty serious about it, too. I don't know if any of you remember this or not, but there used to be a product called Horse Mane and Tail Shampoo. Yeah, they still make it? It supposedly makes your hair grow really fast. And so, man, I took 4 or 5 showers a day. You know, I'm using the hair in Maine. And I was disappointed because I had this vision of this great flowing hair. And it ended up being more like a chia pet. It just kind of all went out like that. But it grew as long as I could. So I go home for Christmas. And my mom sees this hair for the first time. She's used to her clean-cut son. And now, you know, here I am. And I look like, you know, the McDonald's clown. And so She doesn't say anything about it at first, but then I tell her, you know, I'm going to go out and see some friends. And she said, you're going to go out looking like that? And I said, like what? And she said, well, are you going to get a haircut? And I said, no, are you kidding? I've been growing this hair diligently for months. And she said, you can't do that. And I said, well, why not? And she said, we know people in this town. She said, you know, this will be humiliating to me. And it was one of those moments where I think to myself, I can make a big deal out of this, or I can just let it go. I decided to let it go. And even though I had worked very hard to grow my hair, I sat down. She's cutting my hair. And while she's cutting it, I said, you know, Mom, now that I'm in college, it's up to me to decide when I get up. That's true. How you doing? I'm doing fine. I'm not missing classes. I said, you know, Mom, now that I'm away at college, it's up to me to decide what I'm going to eat. Well, how you doing? Well, look at me. I'm healthy. I'm doing fine. Well, good. It's up to me to decide whether I go to class. Well, yeah. How's that going? I'm faithful. You know, my grades are good. Then I hit her with a big one. It's up to me to decide whether I go to church or not. You know, the scissors sort of slow down a bit, and she goes, how's that going? I said, really, it's going great. I found a congregation I really like. You know, I'm even leading some singing there. She said, well, that's really good. So I wait for a minute or two, and then I said, you know, Mom, I'm just thinking, since I'm making all of these other decisions for myself, maybe I could decide when I get a haircut. Just leave it. She doesn't say anything else about it. The entire weekend, nothing happens. I go back to school. About a week later, I get a package from my mother. And some of you who are younger will not appreciate the symbolism, but some of you who are older will. The package, I open it up, and all that's in the package are my mother's apron strings. And it was her way of saying, okay, I'm not crazy about this. This isn't how I would choose for you to look, but I let you go. I love you. I trust you. I'm good. If we had more of that attitude, if more of us could be like my mom, and we'd all be a lot happier. Think about it. Thanks for coming. See you soon.